We're going to continue working through, basically, for those who have been here, we know that like back in September, we started in the very beginning of the Bible, and we've been jumping through, touching on different points in the text. And then starting at Christmas, we kind of leaned into what we call the Gospel of John, John's retelling of the good news of Jesus, where he talks about kind of a philosophical introduction about Jesus being the light in the darkness, the Word made flesh, and all the way through John's gospel to getting to where the resurrected Jesus appears to his disciples and breathes his peace on them, giving them this commission for how they're supposed to live in the world. And then last week, we jumped quite a bit ahead in the story. This band of Jesus followers who were afraid for their lives through the power of the Spirit had become somewhat of a force to be reckoned with, at least around Jerusalem initially, and then eventually beyond. Jesus had gone back to be with the Father, but as this group of Jesus followers kind of made their way in the world, inviting people into trust in Jesus and living this way of Jesus, people began to be freed from bondage and fear. They began to be freed from their dependence on religion and their need to just do whatever the government commanded. They were but that fear brought complications. As people get free from religion, people with power in religious circles don't necessarily like it. As people get free from just saying yes to every single thing a government commands, those who have that power don't really like it. And those early Christians began to be seen as disruptors. And those who were being disrupted would try to crack down. At this point in the story, the Roman government wasn't doing too much because it was such a small group, they couldn't care less. But the Jewish leaders, the religious leaders, were having some real concerns. Last week, we read about how a guy named Saul, who was a faithful and forceful Jewish leader, he both joined and really amped up the active pursuit of these people who follow Jesus. They called themselves the followers of the way. And last week we read about how Saul was confronted by Jesus through a vision, through a bright light, when he was on his way to arrest and potentially kill these new followers of Jesus. And as through this confrontation, he was brought into this community of faith that he was actually attacking. His life got reoriented around Jesus and empowered by the Spirit of God, and he became a part of the disruption. Between then and what we're looking at today, Saul, has been through some stuff. The short version of it is that for as many as 11 years, he had gone to a place called Antioch, and he'd really just been a part of a local church. He'd learned what it looked like, practicing to live the way of Jesus within a community. He had grown into the point where that local church recognized him as a leader within their midst. He was an elder in that local church. And eventually, that local church felt this deep sense from God's Spirit that this guy, Saul, and another guy named Barnabas, that God was putting a special call on their lives to go and tell people more broadly about Jesus and invite them into this way of living. So they commissioned these men to go in this special work to take the good news of Jesus to other communities. Through a variety of circumstances, some of which involved significant conflict, Paul and this other guy, Barnabas, eventually went different ways. They kind of teamed up with different partners to continue sharing the work, sharing the good news of Jesus. So Paul is now Saul. Paul, he goes by both. Saul is the Jewish version. Paul is the Greek version of the name. So same guy. He connects with a guy named Silas. And as they traveled, God led them to an ancient city called Philippi, which is in Macedonia. This city, by the time of Saul, it's already 400 years old. It was established during the Greek Empire when Rome conquered Greece. It became a really important Greek city, a really important Roman city, because it was part of a trade hub. And so it was so important that Rome gave the citizens of Philippi the rights of citizenship, that it was the same for them as if they were lived in Rome itself. So it was very much a Greco-Roman city, Greek history, but a very important Roman settlement. This idea of citizenship does come into play a little bit in this part of the story we're reading today, but I want you to be aware of it because after we spend a couple of weeks in the book of Acts, we're going to spend a few weeks in a book, a biblical book called Philippians, which is a letter Paul wrote to the church in Philippi that is actually just getting established in the story we're reading today. But before we get into the story today, you can, if you have a Bible and you want to turn there, you can turn to Acts 16. If you don't have a Bible, the words will be on the text will be on the screen. You can follow along. But before we get into it, I just want to mention we had our BIC annual meetings, our denominational annual meeting. And just this past weekend, yesterday, there was six of us that were in Port Colborne, Ontario, basically like the Florida of Ontario, I think. We were talking about snowfall and dealing with snow, and the pastor of the church there, which is significantly larger building, significantly larger parking lot, was like, yeah, I think we spent about $900 on snow removal this year. Like, oh. Anyway. So the biggest thing that happened at the annual meeting was our executive director, denominational executive director, Charlie Mashinder, retired, and we installed and welcomed in Todd Lester as our new executive director. And so Todd finished the whole thing by getting up to share a story, or to share a challenge. And he started his challenge by talking about his early days between his undergraduate degree and his graduate degree, and how he needed to earn money, and how he spent time as a taxi driver. And I know many of us sitting in the room were like, wait, this guy we know is a pastor for over 30 years, he's been involved in leadership development for all of this time, we're getting a brand new story about him driving a taxi? And in that moment, we're realizing that people we think we know are a lot more complicated and have a lot more going on than we ever imagined. And I mention that because the story we're going to read today is familiar to many of us. Those who have been in church for a long time, this is a story that many of us have heard. But I think sometimes the characters and the people and the situations that go on are a lot more complicated. And so I want to kind of lean into some of those complications as we read the story. At the beginning of Acts 16, Saul and Silas, or Paul and Silas, they get to Philippi, and they do what they do every town they go to. They go to start by meeting with Jewish people. Philippi apparently didn't have a synagogue where the Jews would gather, and so he goes to where they typically would gather outside of a building, probably along the river, so that they could do their ceremonial cleansings. And he goes and finds them, and he meets someone named Lydia, who is not Jewish. She's a God-fearing Gentile. And he shares the good news of Jesus with her, and she responds and is baptized. She is apparently somewhat wealthy. She invites Paul and Silas and the others that stay with them, which includes the writer of Acts, Luke. She invites them to stay with her in her home while they're there. And so they use that as a home base. And what seems to be happening is they travel from her home back to what is just simply called the place of prayer. This place probably along the river that they would gather. And they travel back and forth from them. And we're picking up the story in Acts chapter 16. As best I can, like I said, we're gonna look at what is said and not said about the different characters and pay attention to some of the things that might be complications to our preconceptions about who these characters are. Let's start in Acts 16, verse 16. Once when we, so Luke is writing this, he's one of the crew that's traveling, when we were going to the place of prayer, we were met by a female slave who had a spirit by which she predicted the future. She earned a great deal of money for her owners by fortune-telling. She followed Paul and the rest of us, shouting, "These men are servants of the Most High God who are telling you the way to be saved." She kept this up for many days. Finally, Paul became so annoyed that he turned around and said to the spirit, "In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to get out of her." At that moment, the spirit left her. Let's pause there just for a second. We're introduced to a young woman, potentially a girl. Like, she could have been anywhere from like 9 years old up to maybe 20, but we don't know, but relatively young. And she's a slave. It's hard to know even what to call the people, like owners, masters. probably use different words today. But they have all of the rights to her and what she does. And it says that she has a spirit in her through which she can kind of see beyond what's on the surface and even beyond the current moment to where she can tell fortunes, apparently, tell the future. In this situation, she's not telling something like kind of in the future, but she's seeing beyond the surface into what's happening in their lives. We don't know how she became a slave, but her life is bound up in making money for those who controlled her. And apparently she was good at it because she made them rich. Notice it says that they got rich, not that she got rich. I think it's good for us to recognize the plight of this young woman who is in control of others. And notice that this passage doesn't say it was an evil spirit. We often presume, because Paul has other interactions with these evil spirits, that he's speaking to something that is dangerous and wrong, but it doesn't say that in this text. Jewish heritage had a long history of people who had a special gift from God by which they could see beyond the current circumstances or even the current time period. We call them prophets, and we often celebrate them. We don't see it as something that was necessarily evil. And having that gift, again, for them, it wasn't necessarily something to be condemned. And Luke doesn't condemn it. Paul doesn't condemn it in this story. In fact, the spirit in her speaks a powerful truth. What she is saying about Paul and Silas is a true thing. And so, prompted by that spirit, this woman starts following them for many days, saying, "These men are servants of the Most High God, who are telling you the way to be saved." As a bit of an aside here, she's described as a slave girl. The word that she uses for Paul and Silas is actually the same word. She's saying, "These are slaves of the Most High God. They are bound to God the way I am bound to my masters." She identifies that they share something with her in that bondage. But their bondage, rather than benefiting in profit for their master, benefits salvation, invites salvation. So after several days of her following them, proclaiming what is true, Paul finally demands in the name of Jesus that the spirit leave her. What prompted Paul to do that? What was that? He was annoyed. He was sick of this girl. There's no indication of any righteous motivation to rescue her from bondage. He was just sick of it and reacted out of annoyance. It doesn't seem to be a great reason to invoke the power of God, but Paul does so, and it's effective, for Paul at least. We don't read much more about the young woman here, but I wonder how effective it was for her. She was a slave. Her gift was being used for the good of her masters, and she was cared for because of that, and now it was gone. Scholars suggest that the social order of the day meant that if she lost her ability to do that, probably sexual exploitation was the next thing on the list for a young woman. It's very possible that Paul's actions, prompted by annoyance, left her in a much more vulnerable position. When you start realizing that, just looking at the details, it's a lot more complicated than maybe some of us have thought about before. Because he was annoyed. Let's continue reading. Verse 19. When her owners realized that their hope of making money was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace to face the authorities. They brought them before the magistrates and said, "These men are Jews and are throwing our city into an uproar by advocating customs unlawful for us Romans to accept or practice." The crowd joined in the attack against Paul and Silas, and the magistrates ordered them to be stripped and beaten with rods. After they had been severely flogged, they were thrown into prison, and the jailer was commanded to guard them carefully. When he received these orders, he put them in the inner cell and fastened their feet in stocks. So here we have Paul and Silas grabbed by what amount to greedy people and thrown in front of the rulers and judges of the city, really on trumped up charges. Prompted by their loss of income, the slave woman's owners, they make political claims about Paul and Silas. They see these guys who are Jewish and presume all kinds of things about them. In Rome, a lot of different religions were permitted, but they were often only permitted for people who were already from that religious group. The idea of proselytizing and getting people who were Roman to leave behind what they believed to enter something new wasn't permitted in many cases. And so their claim is that Paul and Silas, they are advocating for people to leave behind their Romanness to convert to something else, and as such, they need to be treated harshly. These people, obviously, they're wealthy. They obviously have some influence in the city because the crowd joins them in their aggression against Paul and Silas. So by the time they get to the magistrates see an uproar. So when they stand there and say, "Look how these guys are causing this uproar," the magistrates look and like, "Yeah, it looks like they are." Even though, who caused the uproar? It wasn't Paul and Silas. It was the people who lost their wealth. They don't see what is actually going on. But in an effort to keep peace, they have Paul and Silas beaten and cast into prison. And there, the jailer is told to guard them securely. To ensure he's going to fulfill his responsibility, the jailer takes them to the most secure part of the prison. And behind locked doors, he binds them as securely as he can. Again, it's complicated. We may see the magistrates as being against Paul and Silas preaching. That's not what they're doing. They're just trying to calm a chaotic city, a city that's in the uproar. They're trying to act in the best interests of their city. In the name of security, greed manipulates the system. And greedy men have free rein to enact violence on those whose only guilt was that they acted out of annoyance. Again, a little bit more complicated than we sometimes want to pay attention to. Let's continue reading about how Paul and Silas respond. About midnight, Paul and Silas, this is verse 25, sorry. About midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the other prisoners were listening to them. Suddenly, there was such a violent earthquake that the foundations of the prison were shaken. All at once, the prison doors flew open and everyone's chains came loose. The jailer woke up, and when he saw the prison doors open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself because he thought the prisoners had escaped. But Paul shouted, "Don't harm yourself. We are all here." The jailer called for lights. He rushed in and fell trembling before Paul and Silas. He then brought them out and asked, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" In sharp contrast to Paul being really annoyed by a slave girl speaking truth, here we have Paul and Silas beaten, bloodied, and bound, singing and praying in the face of injustice. When Paul thought he was free, he couldn't handle annoyance. But now that he's fully bound, he finds himself leaning into the presence and peace of God. And it appears to have an impact, not only for Paul and Silas and their peace, but also on the lives of those around them. The text notes that the other prisoners are listening to Paul and Silas. And when the earthquake comes, leading to all of the doors opening and the chains falling off, none of the prisoners run. There are lots of theories as to why they may not have run, but the text doesn't tell us why. But what if they've discovered that being in bondage in a place where the presence of God is palpable is more compelling than running into the night away from that presence? We can't be sure, but something holds them there beyond the bars and chains. And in a panic, the jailer, who thought they'd all escaped, grabs a sword to take his own life. We don't know if this was a legal policy, but there is precedent for jailers who allow prisoners to escape being executed. In Acts 12, there's a story where Peter is in prison and gets ushered out. And when the authorities find out that Peter escaped, it says that they were questioned and then killed. So there is precedent for it, and that's what the jailer fears. But Paul intervenes. The jailer, stunned at the circumstances that they could have gotten out, they didn't go, that somehow he doesn't have to be in fear of those who are in charge of him, asks this huge question, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" This word, "sirs," is the word that gets used as Lord. It's someone who has authority over the other. And it's really fascinating because the jailer, who in this situation is the one with power and authority, is looking at the ones in prisoner and calling them Lord. He's saying, like, I am under your authority because you obviously have something more than what I have. And he asks them what he needs to do to be saved. Now, many of us, especially those of us who are products of evangelicalism, are likely to hear this question as referring to eternal salvation. But it isn't necessarily what the jailer is asking. He's just asking to be saved, which can have all kinds of different connotations. Rescued, delivered. It could mean that he's, you know, being asked about how he can be rescued or delivered from the consequences of allowing the doors to be open and the chains falling off. It might also mean something far more profound. As the jailer steps away from the tip of the sword, he may have come face to face for the first time with the reality of the system that he's participating in. A system that jails people who have access to this deep well of peace in the presence of God, while allowing those driven by greed to sit outside and put those people there. He could be face to face with the idea that he's in a system that puts those who are simply trying to follow orders vulnerable to the same abuse that Paul and Silas have been under. He may be asking, you know, how can I be saved from the world and the life that I'm so deeply a part of? Regardless of what he means by "what must I do to be saved," Paul responds by pointing to Jesus. In verse 31, Paul and Silas, as they replied, "Believe in the Lord Jesus, and you will be saved, you and your household." Then they spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all the others in his house. At that hour of the night, the jailer took them and washed their wounds. Then immediately he and all his household were baptized. The jailer brought them into his house and set a meal before them. He was filled with joy because he had come to believe in God, he and his whole household. In this, it seems that several of the possible meanings of this idea of being saved are met. This jailer is baptized into the community of faith through which he's invited into a new way of being, where he's not controlled by the system that he's been a part of. The new way of being that starts now and carries into eternity. I wish we had more of his story about what happened when eventually he and his family would have been taken to meet with Lydia and the other believers. But more than just a new family, the jailer already begins living free from the system of power and control he's been immersed in. Instead of being the one who is there enforcing bondage, he takes these wounded people and begins caring for them. He becomes an agent for healing instead of harm, for blessing instead of bondage, and he is filled with joy instead of fear that just had him at the tip of his own sword. I'm not going to read the next section, but it is fascinating, because in the morning, the magistrates who had put Paul and Silas there, they send a message saying, "Okay, you guys are free. Can you leave town?" And it's like they finally heard the rest of the story and realized, oops, maybe we overstepped. Maybe we can, like, just get them on their way. And it's only then that Paul and Silas reveal, actually, we're Roman citizens, and none of this should have happened to us legally without a fair trial. And that puts the magistrates into a little bit of a panic. They blatantly violated the Roman law. They could have really major issues if word got out. And so rather than leaving, Paul says, actually, they can come down and they can escort us out. He doesn't actually do it quietly. He wants them to come face to face with their rash missteps done at the behest of greedy people. And perhaps that alone will give them sober second thought the next time something happens. The next time they have the power to do something, maybe they'll take a step back and think about whether or not it's right, as opposed to just convenient. The magistrates do come. Paul and Silas visit briefly with Lydia and the new community of Jesus followers who are at her house, and then they proceed on the way. In this passage, we have a lot of complicated people. We have a slave girl exploited by greedy people who speaks truth and is left vulnerable because the good preacher guy gets annoyed. We have Paul and Silas who react out of annoyance to things that are true, but then find a deep sense of consolation and peace when things go completely wrong. We have a jailer who is complicit in systems of abuse, who finds freedom and salvation through those he has power over. But only when those he is over don't take advantage of their opportunity to turn the tables. There's enough complication in this story that to try to draw direct parallels and applications to our reality can be really difficult, maybe even irresponsible. But there are some things that I think we can relate to. First, this story should remind us that all stories, our stories, are way more complicated than we might like to make them. They're filled with complications that we shouldn't shy away from. We shouldn't presume that the vulnerable slave girl is evil or motivated by something nefarious. We shouldn't presume that the magistrates are motivated by justice or by ill will towards Paul and Silas. Let's not believe that the preacher always acts with patience, wisdom, and grace. Just ask his kids. Let's not miss out on the struggling follower of Jesus who has access to peace and patience and presence of God, even in the darkest times. Stories are complicated. Situations are complicated. People are complicated. And that's okay. Second, the complication of things doesn't negate our agency. Most of this story is about the actions of people. Some actions are initiated by God, such as Paul and Silas even traveling to Philippi. Some actions are initiated by faith, such as Lydia responding to the message of Jesus and inviting Paul and Silas into her home. Some actions are initiated by this non-specific spirit, such as the slave woman's testimony about Paul and Silas. Some actions are initiated by greed, some by a desire just to keep calm. Some are initiated by desperation and struggle, such as Paul and Silas singing and praying in prison. Some are motivated by fear, such as the jailer's readiness to take his own life. Some actions are initiated because people are confronted by the love and grace of God. Our story, like their story, is filled with complicated people acting with agency in response to all kinds of things. And being honest about our agency, well, it doesn't let us off the hook by blaming others, either spiritual others or human others. Neither does it leave people defined by how they act. It leaves room for grace and patience and discernment and just figuring out, okay, what's the right next step on this journey? A third thing that I think is really helpful, and this is what I'd love to leave us with, is that this story is filled with complicated people and human actions, some good, some not good. But through it all, God is at work. God is at work to draw Lydia into the way of Jesus. God is at work through Lydia to provide a space for where the church in Philippi can be established. God is at work through Paul and Silas and in their lives, through the prayers, through their songs, bringing a power into that jail that transcends the violence of Rome. God is at work in the life of a jailer, someone complicit in the system of violence, and it transforms him into this agent of peace and healing, moving him from being a man governed by fear to a man filled with joy. In the midst of our complicated stories, as we embrace that complication, it doesn't have to be a sense of everything's messy and we have no hope. It's everything's messy and God is at work. And there is hope and there is transformation, and we can lean into, okay, as those with agency in this complicated, messed up world, how do we act with agency, saying yes to the way of God, who is always with us and always at work in the middle of it? Let me pray and then we'll sing one more song. Father, I'm grateful for these messy, complicated stories. It pushes back against my desire to often just make things simple and presume that what we see on the surface or what we read on the surface is the whole story. God, help us to embrace the messiness that comes with complication and to love each other in the midst of it. And when we struggle because we're complicated people, thank you that your grace abounds that much more. God, thank you that we're invited to walk with you in this messy world and that you are always with us. God, help us to keep our eyes on you, to take the next right step as we're able to, and to just rest that you will never leave us or forsake us and you're always at work among us. In Jesus' name, amen.